This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hi. Welcome to the Lannan Foundation's Readings and Conversations. I'm Tom Barbash. I'm here tonight to introduce my friend and one of my favorite writers, David Mitchell. Before I get started, I just wanted to thank the Lannan Foundation and specifically Christy Masuera Davis for all her hospitality and all the work she's done on behalf of this event. And I'm so excited to be here, and I love your town, city. It's just a wonderful, beautiful place. I was here a few years ago, and it's really terrific. In my years on Earth, I really haven't encountered a writer or a spirit like David Mitchell. I'd read Cloud Atlas and felt by the end of it that my life had improved. My range of experiences expanded by measures. I reviewed it for the San Francisco Chronicle, and what could you say? That it felt 6 times richer, funnier, wiser than anything I could remember reading. 6 distinct worlds, 6 different genres, 6 modes of storytelling. A journal, letters, a potboiler, an extended interview, hints of Melville, Murakami, Nabokov, Chandler, each section I loved more than the last one, though I'll admit a special love for Timothy Cavendish. But then that happened on the flip side of the book, so that the end of Adam Ewing's tale, when that last great line comes, I was quite literally stunned. Why? Because of all the places I'd gone, the lives I'd lived vicariously, the all-too-real vision of a future bleakened by the blind and powerful, because all the threads had somehow come together, each of the stories layering over one another, while on the level of character remaining distinct. We all, likely everyone in this room, thought, who the heck is this guy? And how is it he can do this? I then read Ghostwritten, which A.S. Byatt called the best first book she ever read, and imagined in advance its first book flaws, and finding instead something ghostly, cunning, and fierce. Stories that hit me in different ways than those in Cloud Atlas. In Number 9 Dream, it's the voice and evolving consciousness of Eiji Miyake that drew me in and had me reading way into the night. As innovative and ambitious as he is, David Mitchell's books are kind to readers. There's love and lust, ambition, greed, violence, hypocrisy, revenge, and for the lucky, hard-earned truth. I told him this morning that I love his exquisitely drawn bad guys. Puffed up and cruel, often violent, hypocritical, diabolically manipulative, the bullies in Black Swan Green, the corrupt colleagues of Jacob de Zoet in The Thousand Autumns, the dreadful Dr. Henry Goose in Cloud Atlas, who prey on Mitchell's ethical, vulnerable protagonists until they strike back and we place our books down and cheer. And then I met him in Toronto and found David so very kind and funny, with an evident and abiding love of books and language and the music of language. He's also got a tendency, even in casual speech, to come up with an image so perfect and so funny, you want to scramble for a pen. I had left my copy of Cloud Atlas at home, and I got a new copy with the movie on the front, which I always hate. Though I loved Cloud Atlas, the movie, I have to say. But even in here, there's this little thing about being on the set, and he says, here was Mr. Hanks, Ms. Barry, Mr. Grant, and Mr. Broadbent delivering lines that sounded uncannily familiar. That whole experience felt rather like a dream of finding Gandhi playing Connect Four with your plumber in the cupboard under the stairs. It wasn't so much the individual elements of the scene that were surreal, but their juxtaposition, which is perfect if you know David's writing. There's no sense when he speaks that he's saved these images up for an audience. He's simply wired that way. It seems unfair, though, given what I know of David's work habits and tendency to revise and revise, to call him a natural. But of course he is. It's only that he is the one exception. I think of sports stars, LeBron, Federer, Crass, I know, who combine an almost absurd amount of talent and ambition with a work ethic and an openness to the world around him. He's talked to me of our shared interest in the way people work, the way he creates on the page the stray thoughts of a composer, or accountant, or vanity book publisher, or midwife, or notary, or a host seeking poltergeist. He also profits from his curiosity about other cultures and time periods and temperaments. But at the same time, he's written one of my favorite all-time coming-of-age novels in the brilliant, beautiful Black Swan Green, featuring 13-year-old Jason Taylor, a.k.a. Elliot Bolivar, covertly writing poetry, longing for unattainable girls, and suffering in a household where his parents are slowly drifting apart. The pages David devotes to Jason's stammer and the conversational chess playing he undertakes in order to avoid certain words is like nothing I've read about human speech. What else should you know? That he grew up in the town of Malvern in Worcestershire, England, that he was educated at the University of Kent at Canterbury, that at 24 he fell in love with his now wife, Keiko, and when her visa expired, the two moved to Hiroshima, and he taught English and lived for 8 years. He's lived for a long while now with Keiko and their two children in Clonakilty, a seaside town in County Cork, Ireland. He was shortlisted for the Booker twice. Time magazine, in the wake of Black Swan Green's publication, placed him on the list of the 100 most influential people in the world. Somehow they missed me. With the opening of the movie Cloud Atlas last fall, a whole new world of readers found David Mitchell, and while that's extremely lucky for them, it feels sometimes a little sad for the rest of us, if only for an instance, our secret's out. Katie Guest wrote in The Independent about one of David's novels, "His fans will open the novel feeling nervous of disappointment, yes, but then they will close it in tears and turn immediately back to page one to begin again. To them I say, don't worry. Dive in and lose yourself in a world of incredible scope, originality, and imaginative brilliance. David Mitchell has done it again." I like that. It's fitting that I'm here tonight because among living writers, David is the one I'd most likely travel to another country, another land, and into the future with. His new book, from his descriptions, has the scope of Cloud Atlas and an amazing teenage girl protagonist. I know we all can't wait for it. Please welcome David Mitchell.
Thank you so much. It was just touching, isn't it?
It's not whiskey, it's black tea, honestly. Whiskey with black tea in it, though. That's an idea. That's stage fright. Oh, thank you, Tom. That was problematic, actually, because there's a very strict weight baggage allowance on Ryanair when I fly back from London to Cork. Now my head is going to be too big to... Good heavens. I also have some people to thank. The aforementioned Christy Masuera-Davis with the Lannan Foundation, who's done the hard work behind my bringing me over here, and the Lannan Foundation itself, which I didn't know much about, but what a remarkable reality-improving institution it appears to be. And Jamie Figueroa, excuse my Spanish. Yay! I agree with you. She's amazing. I want to be 16 and one of her students, and if anyone could, if the Lannan Foundation could fix that, especially the being 16 part, then please let me know afterwards. She very graciously invited me to the New Mexico School for the Arts this morning, and I had the pleasure and honor of meeting her and her quite wonderful students. And I wished I was one of you. And I walked around your beautiful town this afternoon, and that just deepened that wish. So thank you very much for having me here. And it sounds as if I'm about to leave the stage now. I'm not. I flew all this way just to receive Tom's eulogy. I'm off now. Oh, and I must thank my friend Tom as well. I can't outdo what he just said, but he's one of my favourite American writers, who will be in the Time magazine list for 2014, if there's any justice in the world. Favourite American writers, favourite Americans, favourite writers, favourite... That's Tom. But he's a great writer in his own right, and it's a great honour he's paid me by taking 3 days out of his busy life to come down here and praise me to the skies. So thank you. Right. Always an odd step. I'm about to hand in a manuscript, which, and I'm not as prolific as I'd like to be, which means that this, my most recent book was out about 3-4 years ago, and I handed it in about 5 years ago, and it feels so borderline fraudulent to be reading something from so long ago, but the new thing isn't quite ready for road testing yet either. So a compromise is just a story that's never been published anywhere apart from the Guardian website, which is pretty public, really. But I almost never read it, and it probably isn't one of your books, and probably a relatively small number of you have come across it. So I'm just going to read this first, and we'll see how we go. And my little magic clock here has started ticking, so I will get on with it. It's just a story called The Massive Rat. My wife strapped in Freddy, shut the door, and turned towards me. I have a 10 o'clock meeting with Patrick Beeman to discuss what needs to be done. I suppose I nodded. Freddy wanted me to do my flesh-eating zombie thing, but after Lorna's declaration, it was beyond me. She said something else that I heard but didn't really hear, climbed into the car and drove off. Freddie looked through the back window. His puzzlement gave me the strength to muster a weak smile and a wave. Lorna's parting words then drew into focus. "Trouble with you is you begin too many sentences with the word I," she had said. I stayed on the drive, contemplating the sequence of spiteful dares that had led to this point of no return, until the sky began gobbing warm rain faster and thicker. Upstairs in my office, lists were waiting, lists of lists. Oh, Jesus, the paperwork ahead. I couldn't face it and ran around the side of the house, down the garden and into the shed. On a half-empty tub of weatherproof paint, I set out a berserking shower. I'd never do anything stupid. I mean, how could I scarf Freddy? But the thought of 10 packets of Nurofen Express waiting in the back of my bedside cupboard was a reassuring one. When Freddy's scarecrow was dripping dry in the sun, I found a mismatched pair of gardening gloves and a trowel and attacked the knotweed and nettles and docks choking the veggie patch. I dug it last year during the banking crisis when the age of supermarkets was looking a bit shaky. Who'll end up eating these courgettes and spuds and onions now? Courgettes? Zucchini? No, that's an eggplant. Is it? No. Right, first time. Don't second-guess yourself, Mitchell. Our back garden is long, thin and mature suburban with a copper beech at the end. Lorna says trees have no business being dark, but it's bruised maroons and shimmering there-nows. Always steady my head. Freddie wants a treehouse. I always meant to build one in the Copper Beech. Nothing fancy, just a sort of tree-borne raft like the one me and David Ockridge built in his dad's back garden when we were kids in Black Swan Green. In my daydream, I'd tell Fred that the Copper Beech is guarding his prezi, and I'd watch him run down and find the rope ladder and climb up to a better, leaf-shushed world. The thought of another man building Freddy's treehouse in an ordinary green beach made me hurl my trowel through the shed window. Shark fins of crashing glass followed the trowel, and after an immobile minute, I shouted, "You stupid effing idiot!" Now I'd have to invent one of my one-legged excuses. Freddy still believes them, probably, but Lorna would think, "Yeah, right. I have to be more careful. The bio of Patrick Beeman will hover over his legal pad. How does your husband's passive aggression tend to manifest itself, Mrs. Breyer?" And she'd reply, "I prefer to be called by my maiden name from now on." It's supposed to be a deeply sad story about a couple drifting apart, and I'm just getting laughter from it. I partly wrote this when Tom and I first met in Toronto. He just read one of his brilliant short stories about a couple who had already got divorced and sort of the imp of envy and said, the imp of envy within said, "I want to do something like that." So this is sort of my most Barbashian story, but not a comedy, people, okay? The weeds on the compost heap, I began feeding the shrubs with the... did it wrong. The weeds on the compost heap... That's an awful sentence, isn't it? Blimey. I'm glad this hasn't been published. It's just around the two clauses of the sentence. One's got a different subject, and it just doesn't work. I'm going to fix this right now. This is just ridiculous. I put the weeds on, then begin. Okay, there we are. That's better. Most artists in one form or another have said that a story or a piece of art's never finished. It's just abandoned or snatched off you, and it's really true. It's just once it is published, you can't do anything about it without organising the biggest product recall since Toyota. And I don't have the resources to do it, but... Anyway, I put the weeds on a compost heap, then began feeding the shrubs with the blood, fish and bone. 3 miles away, Patrick Beeman would be working down a list of bullet points with Lorna. General procedure, custody, money, house, pensions, miscellaneous, standard fees. My mother is going to crumple up. We've kept the troubles well hidden. But whose idea was it first? She'll want to know. Meaning, whose fault is it? There's no somebody else on Lorna's side, I'm sure. She's too miserable to be in love, and God knows I've been too busy trying to keep my alleged consultancy afloat to think about illicit sex beyond the YouTube variety. Middle-aged laughter there. Stop interrupting myself. This has been ridiculous. I'm down to 38 minutes already and only on page 4. We're in trouble. Though sure, there's no denying that the money stuff hasn't helped the marital stuff. When you're a guy and a dad, I told Freddy's scarecrow, and you have to ask your wife to put £5,000 of her bonus into the joint account so that the garage won't refuse your card, and all the jokes about being a kept man are worn away. Well, the word, my friend, is vasectomizing. Garden time swallowed me up because the next thing I knew, Lorna was calling me from the patio. It felt like a humid Friday noontime because it was. This patio scene contained a number of abnormalities, however, like one half of a spot the difference puzzle. First, Lorna was using my name insistently and repeatedly. Since the troubles kicked off, she's become adept at framing sentences in which I don't exist. Second, she was actually maintaining eye contact. She usually addresses the room or the air around me. Third, she was taking the trouble to announce a return instead of leaving it to doors, kettles and cisterns. Fourth, and this shook me most of all, Ms. I Will Survive looked alarmed and needy, and in an instant, a prayer was hurtling its way to the headmasterly god of my Church of England childhood. Please, please, please don't let anything have happened to Freddie. Nick, there's a rat trapped behind the fireplace. This next one's obscure. Good luck. Like Captain Sensible a lifetime ago, I said, what? Oh, a few of you. That'd be good. She said, a rat's trapped behind the fireplace. I neglected to thank God for preserving Freddy. She didn't think I'd heard. A rat is trapped behind the fireplace. Oh, it's not a rat, it's a mouse, I thought, and probably not even a mouse. Lorna has a thing about mice, especially imaginary ones. I said, you mean in the fireplace, in the glassed-in box bit? She said, no, I mean behind the fireplace, as in behind. She does that Australian last syllable lift just to annoy me. What makes you think that? Well, for one thing, I can hear it. The devil made me say, why don't you phone Patrick Beeman? We're learning a lot about contempt, Lorna and me. Fine, she said eventually. Fine, thanks so much. I found myself walking up the garden. She asked, just as I passed, what happened to the shed window? Oh, there was a junk slide and the handle of the mower fell through it. Me and Lorna have sort of Berlined the house into her zone and mine. Freddie passes through the checkpost, through the checkpoints without noticing them, but the living room is deep inside her territory. It's been weeks since I set foot in there. As we knelt beside, before the stove's glass front, something inside, and yes, behind it, sensed us. Invisible claws sprinted up and slid down the steeply sloping iron-cast roof. I have to admit, though I didn't yet, that no mere mouse could make such a hefty scrat, scrat, scratting. Back when we bought the house, back when unborn Freddy was the size and approximate shape of a cashew nut, the hearth was covered with cardboard and brown tape. Dreaming of chestnuts on open fires, we stripped it off to discover that the chimney actually acted as a vertical wind tunnel that sucked the heat out of the house. Our Estonian builder suggested a box stove with a glass door that backed into the pre-existing hearth and a fake marble surround to seal it in. We agreed, but the stove, when it arrived, had only half the depth of the fireplace. So this would create a gap between the back of the stove and the bricks of the hearth. But with Rumsfeldian clarity, our builder assured us, if a thing can get in, a thing can get out. He gets a bad rap, but I love that thing he said about known knowns and unknown knowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns. I've been waiting for that all my life, and it's great, really, really wise. It's just a shame the wisdom didn't always extend to areas of foreign policy, but let's not go there. I'm a guest in your country, I must behave myself. If a thing can get in, a thing can get out. Except, plainly, rats. Lorna wondered aloud whether it might be a bird. Not unless it can unscrew crowbars off chimneys. A rat, then? She glared at me sweatily. Like I said? I wonder how long it's been in there. Well, Fred was watching a DVD yesterday. There was nothing then. 24 hours then, I thought. She asked, isn't there anyone we could phone? Oh, yeah, the RSPCA, Royal Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, as you probably know. Yeah, the RSPCA, they would do a golden eagle or a sea otter, but, oh, thank God you answered, there's a rat stuck behind our fireplace. Dispatch team rodent rescue before it's too late. I meant a vermin controller, she added a basilisk-voiced nick. Oh, well, one stupid rat hardly counts as an infestation. Well, can you pull the surround off and sort of open it up? The rat heard and detonated a volley of heavy claws. Well, not without slicing through the silicon sealant stuff. I said these words like a poor impersonator of a CID officer. She said, we could just leave it and hope it finds its way out. Well, that's a non-solution. It'll get weaker and weaker. The rat climbed and slid and climbed and slid. Lorna swallowed. This would give Fred nightmares, you know. Remember the Doctor Who incident? As if she'd let me forget. What worries me is the stench. If Patrick Beeman advised you to sell the house, it'll cost you a few thousand quid. Suppose we address one shitty problem at a time. Of course, we could sort of light the fire and sort of cook it. Wishing I hadn't said that, I tested the sealant between the stove's front frame and the stone surround with my thumbnail. Lorna said, Annette's bringing Fred back by 2. The mantelpiece clock, a wedding gift, read 12:35. I'll have to pull out the stove somehow. I'll go to the hardware store before they close for lunch. I need to buy some gear. I hope you don't mind all these sentences beginning with I, by the way. The strip of shops is only a quarter hour by foot alongside the railway line and across a park with a slimy pond, but the lack of time called for the car. There was a thing on the news about a divorced dad in Bristol denied the right to see his young sons, and he lost it and shot the family, finishing with himself. I mean, God knows, I'm not saying it's justifiable or that I would or could bludgeon my own soon-to-be ex-wife to death. I'm going to keep the smile off my face. Much less little Fred as he lay asleep before knocking back 120 Nurofen Expresses with a bottle of Kilmagoon. No. All I'm saying is that our own troubles helped me understand why the man in Bristol did it. That's all. Certainly, One Stop Hardware is a place where I could die happy. The smell pacifies me better than any of Lorna's 30 quid a bottle of aromatherapy gunk. It's the iron lard of machine grease, the masculine whiff of the pet products, the pungency of freshly moulded Chinese plastic. The rows and columns of screws and hooks in brass and steel, graded according to thickness and length, they're a visual sedative. There is nothing in this world, avow the displays of tools, so knackered and broken that we cannot sand it down and fix it up. The names of paints are soul-watering. Santorini Dusk, First Tomato, or Martha's Vineyard. I enjoyed the roguish camaraderie of carpenters and electricians who grabbed supplies for their afternoon jobs and bantered with Robbo and the Jonester at the till. Nobody would mistake me for a seasoned professional, but so long as I keep my mouth shut, who's to tell I'm not a competent amateur? So I gathered three types of knives, a fresh tube of Silico 4 Pro, a plunger to apply it, a wide, fat, flat chisel, a pincher clampy thing, and a pair of liver-coloured resin gloves. I paid, put my purchases in a box, and left One Stop. Taking a last backward glance, which is why I failed to notice, the blackberry-wielding meteor hurtling down the pavement until it was too late. Patrick Beeman checked his blackberry wasn't scratched before turning to the man on the pavement. He laughed with dismaying sincerity when he recognised me. Enjoy the trip! He extended his muscular arm to help me up, and my treacherous hand obeyed. No permanent damage, I trust. Lorna is leaving me, I thought, and my coccyx is mashed. I brushed myself down. Oh, never better. I do hope you're well. Oh, mustn't grumble. I trust you had a constructive meeting with Lorna. Patrick Beeman made a sympathetic hum. Sorry about the way things have turned out, but hey-ho, one addresses the details and moves on. Speaking of which, Nick, I can call you Nick, right? You must sort out your own legal representation ASAP. He pronounced this ASAP, which you have to do on the page because it's written ASAP, but of course when you read it aloud, you look a bit of an idiot because it's just what you just said, but can't help it. He watched me gather my spilt purchases. Spot of DIY, is it? Oh, there's a rat trapped behind our fireplace. He made a, that's weird face. Behind, not in. It is finicky to explain. It's one of those slotted in and sealed fireplace jobs. And you really think it's a good idea to open it up yourself? It's either that or live with the stench of a putrefying rat. Well, hey, Patrick Beeman shrugged. I grew up on the Isle of Man. But wear a face mask, though, for Christ's sake. Put yourself in starving, hacked-off Mr. Rat's skin. What's the first thing he sees as light floods into his sunless prison cell? Juicy eyeballs and gristly nose. Dinner. Think American Psycho. Hey-ho. Have your solicitor, whomsoever you appoint... phone me ASAP so we can get the ball rolling. You want to change your wills too, right? Now, I'd rather be dragged over burning coals than smear any of my legal colleagues, but the McQueenie woman over Superdrug is a Pollyanna Cokehead, and I'd not trust Mr. Timothy Finn and Associates with a stapler, let alone access to my only son. Cheery bye for now. Lorna was slicing tomato and basil. We never eat together. But she came into the living room to avert charges of not my problemism. Getting the rat out from the fireplace is one thing, I told her, and packing my box of gear, but getting it out of the house is another. Lorna said, well, we should just make a rat run leading to the front door. I said, obviously. Two rolled up hallway carpets made a single lane highway to the propped open front door. Lorna made a canyon out of the sofa and armchairs leading from the fireplace to the hallway. I remembered decorating the house with warm, funny, pregnant Lorna. Then I opened the window as wide as it would go. Lorna asked, what's that in aid of? The truthful answer would have been to postpone a rat bite for about 10 more seconds, but I replied, a mature black rat can leap as high as you. There's a chance it'll just see the window and go for it. That's classic Nick Briar bullshit, that. Lorna provokes it out of me like a laxative. So the blade slid through the sealant. Lorna was watching from across the room, gripping a tennis racket like a vampire huntress gripping a wooden stake. Upon hearing the knife, the rat flung itself around like a madman. Around then, I realised that the exercise was a bit pointless. The sealant wasn't glue, but just sealant to stop smoke. The frame of the box stove was probably bolted to the floor through its feet, and the surround was immovable unless we ripped out the entire fireplace. Not yet wanting to admit this to Lorna, I carried on with the knife until the middle of the top edge, and words were embossed on a little raised flap, to open frontage, clasp and pull. But I carried on with my knife around the entire frame. Right, that ought to do it. I put on my goggles, clasped the raised flap and squeezed. Lorna asked, there's an opening mechanism. There was resistance, but a spring-loaded latch clunked. The rat responded with a cold-blooded rat-a-tat-tat. Oh, of course there's an opening mechanism, I said, but I had to unseal the silicone surround first. I put on my resin gloves. Well, nice knowing you, Lorna. I pulled. The box section of the stove tipped forwards, which opened a gap of 3 inches along the top edge, and it wouldn't open any further. My pulse twanged, fast and rubbery. Cautious taps, without backslides, climbed up a shallower incline, and I moved back, gripping the other tennis racket. And this blurred brown paw, as big as a dog's, half appeared. Jesus on the crapper, I thought, it must be massive. The paw probed forwards, drawn by the light. It had a single sharp claw, as sharp as a bird's beak, because this is what it was. And a dazed wren was perched on the top edge of the stove. And perhaps it tried to understand the living room and its wrongnesses. But then it launched itself straight at the window, where it would brain itself on the glass and snap its little neck. But through the open window and on, it plunged into the afternoon, into the criss-crossing, traffic-drowsy, leaf-shushed afternoon. And looking at my wife's face, I wish that time would stop. Hey, thank you, guys. Thank you very much. Thanks very much. I've now run out of short stories that I haven't read or haven't put in a book anywhere, so that was that one. So I'm resorting to my latest novel from 4 years ago. It's set in at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, in Japan, in Nagasaki specifically, where the Dutch East Indies Company were permitted to maintain a kind of a trading post throughout the 2.5 centuries when Japan was allegedly closed to the outside world. Wow, this is completely different to this, doesn't it? It's like a different guy. I need a different mask on suddenly. So, and yeah, it was a place called Dejima, and I sort of discovered it by accident in my first winter in Japan when I was much nearer the age of Miss Figueroa's students than I am now. In Japan, in my first winter, I'd gone hitchhiking around Kyushu, the main island in the south of Japan there, and I was after a cheap lunch in Chinatown, but I couldn't read the street signs at all, well, at all, and I got off at the wrong stop and just found this curious sort of small area of looked very like 18th century white warehouses, and that's where I found this place, Dejima. I knew that Japan, as most of us do, that Japan was closed off from the outside world for a long time, but it wasn't quite. There was this little sort of cat flap through which trade was allowed in, and knowledge as well, much more importantly towards the end of the time. And all that the world knew about Japan left via Dejima, and all that Japan knew about the world entered via Dejima. And I thought, well, if I can't write a halfway decent novel about this, then I'm not much of a writer. Actually, I didn't think that, because at the time I was 26 and hadn't published a book or even written a novel, but later I thought that. And yeah, it's the hardest book I've ever written, I think, apart from the one I'm writing now. They seem to get harder as I age, and that's depressing. Honestly, I knocked off Cloud Atlas in about 14 months, and it takes me 14 months to write a scene these days. It's kind of worrying. When you're young, you have the spontaneity, and you don't worry about second-guessing yourself, and you just do it. And that goes as you age, children. Hopefully, you can replace that lost spontaneity with technique and craft. And you better hope it, because that's your only chance. But it seems to be a pretty universal trend, that. So, this is towards the end of the book, when the magistrate of Nagasaki is, without giving any spoilers away, looking at the view of his town for what he has reason to believe may well be the last time. He's not mentioned a lot. This is a bit of a party piece, because in every book, actually, there's one passage which is more polished than any other, because it's the one that the writer goes to straight away when he or she doesn't really feel like sitting down and writing. But you flip open the laptop, and before you really start, you think, I'll just have a look at that one more time. So this was polished and polished and polished. The reason being that it's a bit indulgent, but it's a little gift to myself. On the page, it's just a text, it's just a block of prose. But when it's read aloud, something else happens to it, which I will now try to show you. Gulls wheel through spokes of sunlight over gracious roofs and dowdy thatch, snatching entrails at the marketplace and escaping over cloistered gardens, spike-topped walls and triple-bolted doors. Gulls alight on whitewashed gables, creaking pagodas and dung-ripe stables. They circle over towers and cavernous bells and over hidden squares where urns of urine sit by covered wells, watched by mule drivers, mules and wolf-snouted dogs, ignored by hunchbacked makers of clogs, gather speed up the stoned in the Kashima River and fly beneath the arches of its bridges, glimpsed from kitchen doors, watched by farmers walking high in stony ridges. Gulls fly through clouds clouds of steam from laundry's vats, over kites and threading the corpses of cats, over scholars glimpsing truth in fragile patterns, over bathhouse adulterers, heartbroken slatterns, fishwives dismembering lobsters and crabs, their husbands gutting mackerel on slabs, woodcutters' sons sharpening axes, candle makers rolling waxes, flint-eyed officials milking taxes, Aetoliate lacquerers, mottled-skinned dyers, imprecise soothsayers, unblinking liars, weavers of mats, cutters of rushes, ink-lipped calligraphers dipping their brushes, booksellers ruined by unsold books, ladies-in-waiting, tasters, dressers, filching page boys, runny-nosed cooks, sunless attic nooks where seamstresses prick, calloused fingers, limping malingerers, swineherds, swindlers, lip-chewed debtors rich in excuses, herded all creditors tightening nooses, prisoners haunted by happier lives and aging rakes by other men's wives, skeletal tutors goaded to fits, firemen turned looters when occasion permits, tongue-tied witnesses, purchased judges, mothers-in-law nurturing briars and grudges, apothecaries grinding powders with mortars, palanquins carrying the not-yet-wed daughters, silent nuns, nine-year-old whores, the once were beautiful, gnawed by sores, statues of Jizo, anointed with poses, syphilitic sneezing through rotted-off noses, and potters and barbers and hawkers of oil, and tanners and cutlers and carters of night soil, and gatekeepers, beekeepers, blacksmiths and drapers, torturers, wet nurses, perjurers, cut-purses, the newborn, the growing, the strong and the pliant, the ailing, the dying, the weak, the defiant. And over the roof of a painter withdrawn first from the world and then his family and down into a masterpiece that has in the end withdrawn from its creator. And around again, where their flight began, over the balcony of the room of the last chrysanthemum, where a puddle from last night's rain is evaporating, a puddle in which the magistrate observes the blurred reflections of gulls wheeling through spokes of sunlight. This world, he thinks, contains just one masterpiece, and that is itself. That's that section. Thank you. Thank you very much. Right, I'm going to do one more. I've got 13 minutes and 10 seconds. 9 seconds. 8, 7, 7. Dejima was very heavily policed and spied upon tiny sliver of land. It was actually an offshore island about the size of 5 or 6 tennis courts, really small, walled, connected with by a bridge to the mainland, just a short bridge, the width of this stage probably. And the Dutch weren't normally allowed off, and the only people allowed on were the translators. The Dutch weren't supposed to learn any Japanese, but being brilliant linguists, they did. And the merchants to do business with the Dutch, and also the prostitutes also to do business with the Dutch. So I wanted a kind of a romance element in this, but my wife warned me very gravely that if I wrote another book where really brainless, beautiful Japanese geisha falls for a tall, blonde Westerner. Oh, you're so tall, you're so blonde. Then I won't repeat exactly what she threatened to do to me, but it involved a bread knife, and I'll leave it there. So for that reason, because there are all these spies everywhere, so she couldn't be a geisha. She couldn't be a courtesan. So who could she be? What could she be? And that sort of stipulation by the Honourable Mrs. Mitchell, who got me here tonight just as well, because she gets really angry if she finds out I've been talking about her. They sort of defined really the first part of the novel, which is a good example of sort of the tighter the straitjacket, the more original the act of escapology has to be. So to the aspiring writers in the audience, I'd say impose unreasonable conditions on you, on yourself at the beginning, and this provokes you, hopefully, into originality. That's a theory, at least. But how could I get these this Dutch guy and this Japanese woman, once I worked out who she was, how they can't meet. There's no chance encounters on Dejima. It was sort of a bit like North Korea now. It's arguably the world's first really efficient totalitarian state. So I had the devil of a time trying to work out how to get them to meet. And this is the first answer to that question, what I'm about to read now. The cogs and levers of time swell and buckle in the heat. In the stewed gloom, Jacob hears almost the sugar in its crates, hissing into fused lumps. Come auction day, it shall be sold to the spice merchants for a pittance, or else, as well they know, it must be returned to the ship's hold for a profitless return voyage back to the warehouses of Batavia. The clerk drains his cup of green tea. The bitter dregs make him wince and amplify his headache, but they sharpen his wits. On a bed of clove crates and hempen sacking, Hans Buro lies asleep. Mucus from his nostril runs to his rocky Adam's apple. The scratch of Jacob's quill is joined by a not dissimilar noise from the rafter. It's a rhythmic scratting soon overlain by a tiny, soaring squeak. A he-rat, the young man realises, is mounting his she-rat. I've had a thing about rats this evening. I don't know, it's just going to press. Listening, he becomes enwrapped by memories of women's bodies. This is getting a bit steamy, actually. I should have done the other section. I've already begun. These are not memories he is proud of or ever discusses. I dishonour Anna, he thinks, by dwelling on such things. But the images dwell on him and thicken his blood like arrowroot. Concentrate, you donkey, the clerk orders himself. Concentrate on your work. With difficulty, he returns to his pursuit of the 50 rix dollars fleeing through thickets of forged receipts found in one of Daniel Snicker's boots. He tries to pour more tea into his cup, but the pot is now empty. He calls out, Hans Buro! The boy does not stir. The rutting rats have fallen silent. Wait! Long seconds later, the boy jolts upright. Mr. Dazuto! Jacob raises his ink-smudged cup. Tea, please, Hans Buro. Hans Buro squints and rubs his head and blurts. Huh? More tea, please. Jacob wiggles his teapot. Ocha! Hans Buro sighs, heaves himself up, takes a teapot and plods away. Jacob sharpens his quill, but soon his head is drooping. A hunchbacked dwarf stands silhouetted in the white glare of Boney Alley. Gripped in his hairy hand is a club. No, it's a long joint of bony, blooded pork. Jacob lifts his heavy neck and his stiff neck cricks. The hunchback enters the warehouse, grunting and snuffling. The joint of pork is, in fact, an amputated shin with ankle and foot attached. Nor is the hunchback a hunchback. It is William Pitt, the ape of Dejima. Jacob jumps up and bangs his knee, and the pain is prismatic. William Pitt clambers up a tower of crates with his bloody prize. How in God's name? Jacob rubs his kneecap. How did you come by such a thing? There was no reply but the calm and steady breathing of the sea. And Jacob remembers Dr. Marinus was summoned to the ship yesterday where an Estonian, I just think about Estonians too, where an Estonian seaman's foot had been crushed by a fallen crate. Gangrenous wounds spoiling faster than milk in a Japanese August. The doctor prescribed the knife. The surgery has been performed today in the hospital, so his four students and some local scholars may watch the procedure. However improbably, William Pitt must have forced an entry and stolen the limb. I mean, what other explanation is there? A second figure, momentarily blinded by the warehouse darkness, enters. His willowy chest is heaving with exertion. His blue kimono is covered with an artisan's apron, spattered dark, and strands of hair have escaped from the headscarf that half conceals the right side of his face. Only when he steps into the shaft of light falling from the high window does Jacob see that the pursuer is a young woman. Aside from The washerwomen and a few aunts who serve at the Interpreters Guild, the only women permitted through the Lamb Gate, are prostitutes who are hired for a night, or wives who stay under the roofs of the better-paid officers for longer periods. These costly courtesans are attended by a maid. Jacob's best guess is that the visitor is one such companion who wrestled with William Pitt for the stolen limb, failed to prize it from his grasp, and chased the ape into the warehouse. Voices, Dutch, Japanese, Malay, clatter down Long Street from the hospital. The doorway frames their outlines, brief as blinks, running down Boney Alley. Jacob sifts his meagre Japanese vocabulary for any suitable items. When she notices the red-haired, green-eyed foreigner, she gasps with alarm. "Oh, miss," implores Jacob in Dutch. Please don't worry. The woman studies him and concludes that he offers no threat. "Bad monkey," she regains her composure. "Steel foot." He nods at this and then realizes, "You speak Dutch, miss?" Her shrug replies, "Little." She says, "Bad monkey, enter here?" "Aye, the hairy devil's up there." Jacob indicates William Pitt upon his crates. Wanting to impress the woman, he strides over. "William Pitt, unhand that leg. Give it to me. Give." The ape places the leg at his side, grips his rhubarb pink penis, and twangs it like a harpist in a madhouse, cackling through bared teeth. Jacob fears for his visitor's modesty, but she turns aside to hide her laughter, and in doing so, reveals a burn covering much of the left side of her face. It is dark, blotched, and close up, very conspicuous. "How can a courtesan's maid," Jacob wonders, "earn a living with such a disfigurement?" Too late, he is aware that she is watching him gawp. She pushes back her headscarf and thrusts her cheek towards Jacob. "There," this gesture declares, "you just drink your fill." Jacob's mortified. "Please forgive my rudeness, miss." Fearing she doesn't understand, he holds a deep bow for the count of five. The woman reties her headscarf and directs her attention to William Pitt. Ignoring Jacob, she addresses the ape in lilting Japanese. The thief hugs the leg like a motherless daughter hugs a doll. Determined to cut a better figure, Jacob approaches the tower of crates. He jumps up onto an adjacent chest. "Now you listen to me, you flea-bitten slave." A warm and liquid whiplash smelling of roast beef flays his cheek. In an effort to deflect the warm stream, he loses his balance and tumbles off the chest, head heels over arse, onto the beaten earth. Mortification, thinks Jacob as the pain eases, requires at least a little pride. The woman is leaning against Hans Burrow's improvised cot, but I have no pride left, for I, a Dutchman, am pissed upon by William Pitt. She's dabbing her eyes and shivering with near silent laughter. Anna laughs that way, Jacob thinks. Anna laughs that very way. "Hi, sorry," she inhales deeply and her lips twitch. "Excuse my lewdness?" "Rudeness, miss," he goes to the water pail. "Rude, with an R." "Rudeness," she repeats, "with an R. It is nothing funny." Jacob washes his face, but to rinse the monkey urine from his second-best linen shirt, he must first remove it, and to do so here is out of the question. "You wish," she hunts in a sleeve pocket before taking out a closed fan and putting it on a crate of raw sugar, then produces a square of paper. "You wish wiped face?" "Most kind." Jacob takes it and dabs his brow and cheek. "Trade with monkey," she suggests. "Trade thing for leg?" Jacob gives the idea it's due. Rather beast is a slave for tobacco. "The tobacco," she clasps her hands once in resolve. "You have?" Jacob hands her the last of his Javanese leaf in a leather pouch. She dangles the bait from a broom head, level with William Pitt's airy. The ape reaches out. The woman sways it away, mumbling entreaties, before William Pitt lets go of the leg to seize his new prize. The limb thumps to earth and stops dead at the woman's foot. She gives Jacob a glance of triumph, discards the broom and takes up the amputated limb as casually as a farmhand picking up a turnip. Its hacked through bone pokes from the bloody sheath and its toes are grubby. Up above, the casement rattles. William Pitt has escaped through the window with his bounty over the roofs of Long Street. "Tobacco is loose, sir," says the woman. "Very sorry." "Oh, no matter, miss. You have your leg." "Well, not your leg." Shouted questions and answers fly up and down Boney Alley. Jacob and his visitor take a couple of steps back from each other. "Forgive me, miss, but are you a courtesan's maid?" "Courtesanzu maido?" This baffles her. "What is?" "Courtesan's maid." Jacob grasps for a substitute word. "Whore's helper?" She lays a limb on a square of cloth. "Why horse need helper?" A guard appears in the doorway. He sees the Dutchman, the young woman, and the lost foot. He grins and shouts into Boney Alley, and within moments, more guards, inspectors, and officials arrive, followed by Deputy Van Cleef and Dejima's strutting constable, Kosugi, Marinus's assistant, Ilatu, his apron as bloodied as the burnt woman's. Ari Hrot and a Japanese merchant with darting eyes, several scholars, and Kontumi carrying his carpenter's rule and asking Jacob in English, "What's that feckin' smell about you, man?" He's supposed to be Irish, but I can't do an Irish accent despite living there. I can't do an Irish accent because I live there. It's too dangerous. So I resorted to Scottish there. Apologies to any Scots in the audience. Probably in smaller numbers here, so I'm safer. When I did this reading in Edinburgh, I gave him a French accent. It depends where I was. Jacob remembers his half-restored ledger on the table, wide open for all to see. Hastily, he conceals it, just as four youths arrive, each with shaven heads of medical disciples and aprons like the burned woman's, and commence to fire questions at her. The clerk guesses that these are Dr. Malinus's seminarians, and soon the intruders let the woman recount her story. She indicates the tower of crates where William Pitt clambered up, and now gestures at Jacob, who blushes as 20 or 30 heads look his way. She speaks her language with quiet self-possession. The clerk awaits the hilarity that must greet his dousing in ape piss, but she omits the episode, it seems, and her narrative ends in nods of approval. Toomey leaves with the Estonian's limb to fashion a wooden substitute of the same length. "I saw you," Van Cleef snatches a guard's sleeve. You damned thief. A shower of bright red nutmeg berries spills across the floor. "Bart Fisher showed his blasted robbers out of our warehouse." The deputy makes herding motions towards the door, shouting, "Out, out, quote, frisk whoever looks suspicious. Aye, just as they frisk us. Dazoot, watch our merchandise or it'll sprout legs and walk." Jacob stands on a crate, the better to survey the departing visitors. He sees the burned maid step into the sunlit alley, assisting a frail scholar. And contrary to his expectations, she turns and waves her hand. Jacob's delighted by this secret acknowledgement and waves back. "No," he sees, "she's just shielding her eyes from the sun." Yawning, Hansaburo enters, carrying a fresh pot of tea. "Oh, you didn't even ask her name," Jacob realizes. "Jacob the Bonehead." He notices that she left behind the closed fan on the crate of raw sugar. Storm-faced, Van Cleef leaves last, pushing past Hansaburo, who stands at the threshold, holding the pot of tea. Hansaburo asks, "Thing happen?" 000. Thank you very much, guys. Thanks. Really, thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I think, given the reading, I should begin by asking you about rats.
Rats, yeah. I had a rat's day, didn't I? Rat. What did you say about rats?
I think I was going to ask about whether there's a sense... when you look at each book, there's such a each book is a departure from the previous one, and there must be some pressure when you write each book as it's a success to write something that's similar and build on it, and especially after Cloud Atlas, I would imagine. And it's a different trajectory, of course, to do a coming of age novel after you do the sort of big ambitious book, but also then you do something completely different, and maybe that's the challenge. You know, in a sense, I think each time you put a new challenge in front of you, and perhaps it just becomes exciting. I mean, Jacob de Zoet is really your first third person book. It's the most deeply historical. But if you could talk about, I guess, when you're done
And I know from talking to you, I think, or I'd also like to ask that question, how far in advance are you planning your books, and what sort of a sense, is there a sense of doing something entirely different when you're done with one?
Great, Tom, thanks, yeah. About three questions.
Yes.
I'll try hold them all
begin
in my
with
head
rats.
Rats are useful animals. I don't have much to say about rats, really. Maybe we'll come back to them later. So how far ahead do I plan novels?
Or maybe start with, is there a sense of wanting to do something? When you finished Jacob de Zoet, was there a desire to do something different? As you finish each book, is there a desire, okay, I want to do something entirely different?
Yes, there is. I just have to expand on that answer a little bit. Do sometimes get a bit alarmed, Tom, how there's lots of writers our age out there working, even more in their 30s, in fact, but relatively few in their 60s and 70s still writing really vital, worthwhile work, writing anything, so getting published. And I think about this and get mildly concerned about literary longevity. How do the ones who are still out there, how do they do it? Still really writing good work that you pre-order with your local bookshop. I almost said pre-order with Amazon, but I mean local bookshop because it's really important. Support local bookshops because they're great. But not that many. I mean, writers in their 60s still doing really great work rather than local bookshops. I think you can fade away by repeating your big success again and again, and diminishing returns kick in. And also, why bother? You've done it once already. You perceive that there's some pressure there, but this is sort of one of the joys, in a way, of being a literary-ish writer rather than someone writing a sequence of stories starring the same detective. You do actually... That pressure is largely imaginary, at least if you have a decent relationship with your publisher. You can kind of write what you want. And so it's good to use that freedom. It's good to keep stretching yourself. It's good to keep learning. You can't do that if you're repeating yourself. And the challenge is important. Well, the challenge is the straitjacket that I accidentally stumbled upon earlier. I didn't know how to write a historical novel. I'd never done them. I thought they were relatively easy. Idiot! They're a nightmare. Don't do it, people. Don't do it. But, the things you learn from it.
What were the biggest challenges? Or
the language. Every time the language. I tried doing it in the first person, but then what language are these people thinking in? Are they thinking in archaic English? I wrote the first 50 pages of the first manuscript. I kind of combed through the 19th century crew, through Smollett and Fielding and people like that, for Richardson, for phrases and items and grammar that we don't use in early 21st century English. Did a really conscientious job. Wrote about 50 pages of it. Handed it to my wife, expecting some kind of admiration. She said, "It's like Blackadder." They're all sort of... And yeah, she was right. But then if you ignore... If you write it in early 21st century English, that doesn't sound right either. It sounds like the sitcom Friends. It sounds like... And so you sort of have to create this... I ended up calling it bygoneese. You sort of have to... It's the lest or in case dilemma. So you've got clause A, the precaution, in case. Clause B, the feared consequence of not using the precaution. In case is actually quite modern. Up till, don't know, but end of the 19th century, people would use lest. So take an umbrella, Tom, lest it rain later. And that's in this, I didn't know which sort of. Every sentence, there's a judgment call. There's a lest, in case, level, difficulty, judgment call. Every single word. Ought it to smell archaic, or is it too archaic, or what? So that was a really hard thing about that book. We have drifted again a long way from your original question, Tom.
No, but I think there's also a deep pleasure for the reader in the exactitude of the. I mean, there's so many exquisite details, and maybe they're period details, but the work that you've put in has this tremendous payoff too, because it's very vivid, very tactile. You know, I talked to you earlier about remembering the sort of the whistling sound of the execution, the splatter of blood on Jacob's shoe. Just little. There's tons of small details. Yes, that I love. But what I find interesting in you suggesting how difficult it is there seems to be an ease that you've had in writing a futuristic story. And if you think, I mean, now your new novel, some of it's going to be set, or maybe I can ask you what the challenge of writing in the future, is there greater freedom in Cloud Atlas? Two sections of it are obviously in the distant future. So.
Yeah. I thought there was at the time, because I was younger and stupider and didn't really know what I was doing, and that in a weird way insulated me, and luckily I got away with it with Cloud Atlas. You think the future's easier because you can make it all up, and it's just difficult in a different way. I appear to be sort of going on and on about how difficult writing is this evening. It is and it isn't. It's as you know, it's a joy when it goes well. There's nothing like it. You know, you've got just a well-crafted sentence, and there's nothing wrong with
it. Let me ask you in terms of crafting it. I think, I mean, specifically I'm thinking of Somni's story, the clone story, and how the sort of the creation of the idea of a corpocracy, and so many, I think that the power of your writing about the future is how much it reflects about our times, and it seems like it's a good way to get at things that would be too didactic if you're going directly in something present day.
Fair play, yeah. The best science fiction's always about the future. 1984 was about the totalitarian states in the middle of the 20th century, and most certainly that's true, I think. I'm agreeing with you rather than expanding your statement into a really interesting riff, aren't I? The past is difficult because you can get stuff wrong. Past is difficult because you drown in your research and you end up with sentences like, well, m'lady, would you like me to light the dark room using pig tallow candles, which are cheap but will not allow her ladyship to read because the smoke gets in your eyes? Or would you prefer the sperm whale oil ceiling lamps, which burn with a brighter light but will permit her ladyship to write her diary? Which, of course, you're laughing, as you should, because it's ridiculous. But lots of historical novels do that. The writer just can't resist putting the research in. So you have to do it all. You have to know it all. Like your book now. You have to know everything there is to know about New York in 1980 and then hide 94% of it.
Right.
95 on a good day. Yeah. So that's sort of, those are various reasons why the past is difficult to do. The future's difficult to do because there's no infinity filter. What aren't you going to put in? That's always a tricky one, don't you think? It's not so much what you put in as what you're leaving out. And they're not necessarily the same thing. That's why I like the first person so much. Oh, yeah, I that was a digression from earlier. I tried to do this in the first person. Every possible way of making it the first person, because I just didn't have the confidence that I could do it in the third person, because there's no infinity filter in the third person. What do you leave out? If it's in the first person, you know that, well, the infinity filter is the horizon of your protagonist, the person who's doing the speaking, the person who's doing the doing. The whole book is defined by who they are. You know who they are, you know what they're going to say, what they're going to do, that's your plot. With the third person, there's no such filter. So I was sort of working myself up into an awful state about it. And Antonio Bayer, A.S. Bayer, he mentioned earlier, I said what I just said just now, and she gave me a very, you idiot, kind of a look and said, all you do is you write what you think the reader wants to hear. And, oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a Homer Simpson moment for me, for which I'll forever be grateful to her. So, the future, there's no infinity filter. You've got to... If I may name drop for a moment, I was speaking to Lana Wachowski about this, is making another futuristic science fiction film with her brother. And she says how tired she gets of having to design everything, every single thing in every single shot. Like, what's this going to look like in 200 years? What will a pen look like? They have to design everything. That's the tricky thing about the future. The past, you can't make anything up. Well, the big stuff you can't change. This is another thing I discovered with historical fiction. If anyone's doing a historical novel, I give this to you free, included with the price of admission. You mustn't change the big stuff. The dates of the Napoleonic War, for example. Otherwise, you're writing alternative history. You have to change the small stuff. Otherwise, you write the biographies. Well, you're writing history. You're writing the biographies of real people. So Jacob de Zoet was based on the real boss of Dejima during the time, but I didn't use his name because otherwise it turns into a history of him. The medium-sized stuff you bend. Okay, so big stuff, don't touch. Small stuff, make it up. Medium-sized stuff, you can bend a bit. And I forgot what I was going to say next because my body thinks it's 5:30 a.m. and is screaming at me, what are you doing? Why aren't you in bed? Excuse me, more tea. So.
Whiskey with a tea bag, get it?
We can swiftly move on because I'm burning up in midair.
Not at all. So I think something a lot of people would like to know about was the experience of having Cloud Atlas made into a movie, I have to say, if you haven't seen it, you really should. I thought it was just wonderful, and really, I couldn't imagine how they could make a movie of that book, and I really thought whoever made it had read it so intensely. I was happy with that. It wasn't a superficial treatment, and it's gorgeous to look at. But I'm wondering what your experience of having it made and then seeing it.
Have you ever had that experience where another human being is speaking your words? Has this happened to you in any form? It has. It's a bit odd, isn't it? You think of the lines and then they're said by someone else.
I had someone read a story on radio, and it was the first time I ever experienced the story as not something I'd written, had lived.
So, yeah. It's not yours in quite the same way anymore.
Right.
I mean, it isn't yours when it's published out there and sent, but because it's not filmed, it's still kind of yours.
Right.
Or it's... You're still in the three-way deal between your mind, the book, and your reader's mind. When it's on a film, you're cut out of that three-way deal. It's now the director's mind, the artifact, the film, and pretty much... Not so much the viewer's mind, but the viewer's eyeball. So the stage and the chain is different. But that's what you sell when you sign the dotted line on the option form, of course. So don't complain about it. Or hand the money back, and that's out of the question. It was great. I mean, that's a short answer. It was great. The three directors, they're artists of integrity and great intelligence. They know the book much more. They know the depth of knowledge about Cloud Atlas is far deeper than mine now. It really is. And they disassembled the novel and reassembled it in the shape of a film. The idea of having actors play multiple roles in different time zones so that the character isn't actually a single character, but a segment in the trajectory of a soul. That is audaciously clever. And of course, you can't do it in a book because you don't have actors. You don't have faces. You describe faces, but it's not an actor's face. So I thought they were very good at reinterpreting the book into a film which did what only film can do. Does that make sense, or am I jet-lagged again? That makes sense.
Yeah. Right.
Best of all was just the access to the film world. You touched on, we've been talking a bit about just the importance of work in a character. I think it's really underrated. What job does a character do? And I'd urge the writers and the audience to consider this deeply when you're building a character. The job isn't just it's not the garnish of parsley on the side. It's pretty close to being the main course. It's just as it does in our own lives, the job you do. It's how you spend most of your life. And therefore, as a writer, you sort of need to be a sort of job anthropologist. You need to sort of investigate other people's tribes, other jobs' tribes, and find out their rituals. So, speaking well, the actors themselves, they're interesting people, the directors, but the dialogue coaches, or I spoke to a person whose job it is to he pays his mortgage by designing futuristic spaceships. What a job!
I had that job before.
Yeah. the design people, the costume makers, it's wonderful speaking, the stuntmen and women, it's wonderful speaking with them and getting their take on their job and their take, therefore, on the world. And, of course, it goes into the raw material tank, which you need to keep full. If you, going back to the longevity question, you win by, what's a noun from omnivorous? Omnivoracity, is that a word? That's a word, isn't it? Is it omnivorousness or omnivoracity? Omnivoracity is such a better word, so I'm going to go with omnivoracity. You win with omnivoracity of reading and of life experiences and of being nosy about other people's jobs. Your curiosity is your greatest asset, I think. You reckon?
I do, and I want to say something about the omnivoracity, or
omnivoracity.
Omnivoracity.
Repeat after me. Omnivoracity. Six syllables, which for no sleep is brilliant.
Yes. And a couple. I was noting when you were reading, and I noted all the time when I read your work, is the playful use of verbs. You know, and you come up with things. We Berlined, you know, my pulse twanged. There's a lot of you do your verbs. You have this a kind of interesting, playful language often that comes through on verbs. And I'm wondering if that's conscious. So.
Thanks. Only if that character's relationship with language permits it. Right. So that's the rule. Work's important, but I'm sure you'd agree, your character's relationship with language. We all have one. We don't think about it much, generally. Writers have to, because we become the most awful word nerds, as you might have noticed. And I was speaking about it with the wonderful students I met this morning as well, this very subject. An example I like would your character use a word, a high register word like mellifluous? Or would a character not say that? Would the character say, he's pretty good at getting his point across? They mean the same thing, but if you get it right, then your character starts to breathe and you tell the reader all sorts of useful things about the character. You're a short story guy, you really know this more than I do, because you have to do so much in 3,000 or 4,000 words. If you can save a sentence like, Bill had been to a good school and had a good education, you can get rid of that sentence just by having Bill use the word mellifluous. Isn't that great? And as the reader, you kind of, you sense at some level that you're being treated as an adult, and it's that lovely participative thing that reading does. You're involved in the process, and the writer knows you know that only educated people are going to be using a word like mellifluous, and a virtuous spiral kicks in, and that's why you buy Tom Barbash's short stories instead of someone else's, because you do this all the time. So
mellifluous is in every one of my stories.
If a character can be and does do creativity with language and use Berlin as a verb, then great, do it. But if not, then of course you mustn't, for exactly the same reason.
Which, then, the next question that I would ask on that is how crucial the discovery of the voice is in the process, or where, what do you begin with when you're, you know, I mean, do you see the novel? Do you begin with the voice, some sort of conflict, place? I mean, place is very important in your work. I mean, and it's probably a combination of things, but voice is so central to everything you've written just about. So I'm wondering how, when you find the voice, or whether you start writing about a place and a situation and find the voice, or when does that?
Think of the character. From the character comes the voice, because you're working out what that character's relationship with language
is. But that's outside of writing, you know, before you sort of feel like you're writing the book?
This will age me again, but did you ever have, in the States, I'm sure you did, you invented them here, but those arcade games in old-style arcades where you put a coin in, and this is quite a complicated one for about 3 or 4 players. There were little horses that ran around little grooves, and you put a coin in, and one player had a horse. And there's a big kind of glassed-in table with a racetrack. If you're under 25, you won't know what the hell I'm talking about. If you're older, you had these in the States too, I'm guessing.
They've got one in San Francisco. It's like an old-style arcade-type thing.
Okay.
They have it.
Yeah. Those horses are character, plot, structure, ideas, and style. Voice, I'm going to include in character. When the plot gets ahead, then, because kind of the point is to keep the players interested, no one horse just goes zoom and wins at the end. Kind of the horse, kind of one horse moves forward, and that horse's owner thinks, yeah, I'm going to win, and then another horse moves forward, and they kind of move forward in sort of a jerky, sequential a slide around the track. Handily, one horse per finger. But when you're writing, the plot gets too far ahead, you need to kind of go back and focus on the characters for a bit, and then you realise your structure's a god-awful mess, because this plot means that the structure you had in mind no longer applies, and then because the character's doing that the plot's going there, then actually it's not about death, it's about washing machines. So sort of the idea, theme, kind of horse catches up then, and they sort of lurch on like this, until hopefully where the metaphor breaks down is in the game, just one wins. In the novel, you are hoping for a beautiful, harmonious, simultaneous crossing of the five horses of novel elements across the finishing line at exactly the same moment, and you have perfection. You never really succeed, but you aim for it. It's a shame you can't stop there, but there's 1:41 to go. So,
but I'm going to segue from the horses at the finish line to say that you're close, or you're fairly close now to the finish line. How's that for a transition of this new book?
It's really good. You could do this for a living.
And if you could talk as much as you're comfortable about what this book is, you know, how you see it.
Bless you. As you know, it's a bit risky because it goes onto Wikipedia, and there's so much false information about what the new book is. So you can see the trail of my changes of mind. You find that art's made of changes of mind, and the times you have to throw out a whole load of work. But you know, your first few manuscripts are the scaffold. I'm being evasive, aren't I? It's 6 parts set in 1984, 1991, 2004, 2014 through to 2020. That's a sort of 6-in-1. 2025 and 2038 in the life of the one female character throughout, who we meet as a stroppy teenager, then as a young woman, a reluctant lover, and then as a mother and husband of a foreign correspondent who's never there, and then oddly enough, a successful writer. Hesitated. Have you ever written about a writer? You kind of don't quite want to go there because it feels a bit some sort of weird.
A journalist, but
that's close enough. I use composers. I use music to write about writing, but then this time. I'm actually really going to plunge in, and there's this section set in the world of
Although Jason was a poet. So, yeah.
He was.
And you say a lot of things in the dialogue that he has with his kooky mentor,
about
which I love. I mean, a lot of beautiful things
kooky,
about writing.
That's a great word. Kooky. I must use that more. Kooky. Thank you. So there's I don't, if I'm going to do it, I won't do it in a half-hearted way. I'll do it in a whole-hearted way, just write about writing. But it's only on six of the books, so it doesn't take over. Then she's older, she's a widow, and then she's an old woman. And this is sort of, her life is erupted into by a supernatural theme between two tribes of immortals who are trying to destroy the other, a sort of invisible war going on all around us. One relatively benign group and one much more dangerous and malign group that the benign ones are trying to save us from. This is something like Twilight, isn't it? I'm in trouble. I have to start again. Tell my editor, no, it's off. Sorry, it's been done. What do you think? Should we end on that disastrous note?
I think we'll end on that note. Thank you so much, everybody.
Hey, thank you, too. So. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.